Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I've got one of my dear friends and also colleagues, Chantal Zorzi, joining us today, all the way from Montreal. She is a research assistant intern at the University of Montreal, working with virtual reality for perinatal mental health. She's also a PhD candidate at the University of Kent. Hi, Chantal.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. I just wanted to ask you, what drove you to start a PhD?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. So I did my undergraduate degree in biomedical engineering at the University of Kent, and throughout my undergrad, I had a lot of supportive mentors and supervisors, and it really pushed me to work on projects that were of my interest and explore my passions. And for my third year project, there were no projects from the options that we were given that really interested me. So my supervisor and I came up with this project ourselves that was essentially virtual reality that could be controlled without a joystick. And it was meant for people who use wheelchairs and can't use a regular joystick to control movement in VR. And I really enjoyed working on that, and that really motivated me to pursue a PhD in the same field. So my third year project was essentially a pre-PhD little study
Yeah.
where I found out how much I was interested in the topic, and then I decided, okay, I want to do a PhD in this field.
Wow, that sounds so interesting. How was your work environment when you started off at the University of Kent? Do you feel like you, obviously from supervisors, from my experience as well, academic advisors and just supervisors in general have been quite supportive in that kind of way. But in terms of resources, how did you feel you were supported at the university?
Well, I do have to say before that when I started my PhD, it was September 2020,
Yeah.
COVID, lots of uncertainties. We couldn't really go in the lab as much as we would have liked. And this affected not only me, but everyone around the world in different work environments, and everyone had a really hard time. So at the very beginning, I would say I did not really feel supported, but it wasn't the university per se. It
Yeah.
was in my personal life. Like everyone went through that.
Yeah.
But I do think throughout, once the lockdown had stopped and we could go back in the lab, I really enjoyed going in and seeing my friends and seeing friendly faces, having someone to chat to. It was very different than working from home and being by myself all the time. I could have nice little coffee breaks. And I think, even though that's not a proper resource per se, that was very important to get me through long days of the project not working, code not working, having just a supportive environment from friends in my lab. Resources wise, for my project, I did not need that many researches or to buy too fancy technical equipments, so I can't really speak in that regard. But everything I needed was provided to me, whether that was from the university or from the supervisors themselves, who really fought for me to have the equipment that I needed, even if that came out of a budget that they had.
Sounds really good. And I think also it's really important when you're working for, 3 or 4 years on the same project, having those resources, having people who support you is really, really important. As you say, just kind of taking care of yourself and your mental health as well. But I also wanted to ask you, in terms of a typical like day-to-day kind of scenario, how would you explain a day-to-day lifestyle of a PhD student? If there's anyone out there listening wanting to pursue a PhD, and especially for younger women out there, because I know a lot of people are scared when they hear a PhD in engineering, they feel, oh, that might be something that's really male dominant or something that might be a stereotypical thing that's only for males, but At the moment, I know there are a lot of people who might be listening who are thinking, oh, I want to do a PhD, not necessarily in engineering or maybe in a STEM field. How would you introduce that to someone like that? What would they be doing on a day-to-day basis?
I think the most important thing someone has to keep in mind when they are starting a PhD is that any work that they don't do will just reflect bad on them. It will just push their own deadlines behind. A PhD is, in a sense, a lonely journey because you're by yourself and you're working on this project for years, and you mainly only have yourself as a support. So you really need to be on it. Every day when you wake up, you have to make the effort to, okay, go in the lab or just go to the library or do some work at home, wherever you feel most comfortable to work in. But you really have to find the motivation yourself. And I think that's the key ingredient for a PhD. And that's something that you need to do consciously every single day because no one else, everyone in academia has their own projects to worry about. And even if other people rely on your project, at the end of the day, you're the one that relies most on it. For me, there was not necessarily a typical day-to-day because I didn't go every day in the lab. And I think another great thing the PhD offers you, even though, yes, you do work a lot on your own, the good part of that is that you're very flexible with your schedule. If you don't want to wake up at 7 a.m. to start work at 9 and finish at 5, you can wake up a bit later and just finish a bit later. You just need to make sure by the end of the week you have your deadlines met, you have met all of your deadlines that you have set for yourself that week. And so it's very flexible. You don't really need to do the same thing every day as long as you do a bit every day to have enough of it completed. And maybe some days you will work 10 hours, 15 hours even. And then other days you might just work 2 or 3 hours. And that's the great thing about a PhD. But it does take a lot of time management and self-motivation. So those are really important to have.
Yeah, I think, as you say, having that discipline is really, really important. Throughout the years as well, maintaining that discipline, you can start off being really passionate about, I think we had this conversation before, but you can start off really passionate about your subject. But things just might come around. You might have days that you feel really motivated that you want to work and everything kind of works out for you. Technicians might be there on time, software might be working perfectly, your code might be working perfectly. And the next couple of days, you might feel like you've only done 2 or 3 hours of research. But I think it all adds up in the end, doesn't it?
Honestly, that's the thing. Sometimes everything works perfectly. Sometimes nothing works the way you wanted it to. And oftentimes when that happens, it's because one of your apps had a software update and the other didn't, and now they're not compatible anymore. And you're sitting there for hours trying to figure out what you did wrong, not remembering you changed anything in your code. And then it was just a silly update, or you put a comma where it wasn't supposed to be, and now nothing works anymore. So it can be really frustrating, but when it does work, it's very, very rewarding. And that's, I think, something a lot of us can relate to. And the motivation that helps us keep going is that rewarding moment after nothing works, that when everything starts working again.
That's so true. But I feel also, obviously, we're taking it step by step. I think in your first year, when you've just started off, just to put a bit of background to people who might be listening and wondering, what is a PhD in science? Like, what is a PhD into the STEM field? So, starting off with your first year, you kind of have to deliver something, you deliver a written piece of work. It could be a literature review, it could be an experiment, it could be a bit of both. In terms of kind of gathering this type of information, not certain, this wouldn't necessarily be data, but mostly literature coming from, the academic community, putting your papers together. Is there any tips and tricks that you could maybe give someone who's in their first year of their PhD, looking to kind of write their first chapter, which would be this literature review? I had my own way of working with things, but I just wanted to hear from you. How did you kind of select the papers that you wanted to work with and put them all together?
Well, I did really struggle with that at the beginning because I had no prior experience doing a literature review. So it was hard for me to realize, okay, I need to actually follow a guideline. I can't just go on Google Scholars and look up my topic and try to find whatever interests me. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it's really good that out there, there's so many guidelines, whether you follow the Johanna Briggs Institute guidelines for scoping, systematic meta-analysis, Prisma, or whatever you follow, these guidelines have a very set structure. So you're also not left alone. You know, okay, step one, I need to do this. Step two, I need to do that. And then there's lots of different tutorials on different databases that you can use to research your topic. And based on your field, obviously, you would use different databases. Whether you do psychology or engineering, you would probably not use the same databases to look at the literature. But a lot of institutions have librarians that can help you guide through them. And that's a resource I think students really need to take advantage of them. Contact their librarian of their field of study, and that can really help you figure out what databases to use and help you break down the topics that you should be researching. Because when you have a research question, you need to break it down in different topics, and then you need to find the keywords for these topics. And then you need to combine them with either and or based on what you're looking. And if you've never done it, it's very, very confusing. So really go out to a librarian, ask them for their help, because they really know how to do this and follow these guidelines. Because it's not only going to help you better to follow these guidelines, but if you're planning on publishing your work, showing that you have followed a guideline, you have consulted with a librarian, you've had feedback from people, will increase your chances of publishing your work. Because papers, well, sorry, journals will see, okay, you've actually done a thorough search, you've looked at all the evidence available, and you've systematically analyzed it and filtered it out rather than just like, oh, this paper looks cool and this paper looks cool.
But then
So
also, I feel like, in a way, when you're trying to filter out these papers, it can become quite difficult, as you say, because not all of the papers are relevant to your field.
yeah.
So, having that kind of, as you say, having someone to guide you, having someone like a librarian, because I know from past experiences, librarians are there to help. So,
Yeah.
if you have an issue or you feel like, as you say, if it's your first time writing a literature review and you feel just a little bit confused, because your supervisor will be there, but you need someone who's going to back you up, who's going to send you, as you say, there are different templates that you can use. For Prisma, for example, there is the flowchart that you can use, and there are several tools out there. So readily available tools that students should make use of, I think. And it's really difficult, even in terms of trying to choose journals that you'd like to publish in. I think that has been a struggle for me as well from the beginning. But since you're in virtual reality, and I'm presuming that could be quite a subjective kind of topic, but is there any advice you'd give when you're trying to choose journals? I know there are a couple of tools out there you can kind of, again, filter out and see which journal is relevant for your paper. But from previous publications, are there any tips in terms of reviewers and reviewers' comments? Because I know a lot of people struggle with that. And sometimes with reviewers, there are conflicting ideas as well. Is there anything that you feel current students and current PhD candidates have to be wary of when, replying to these comments? Is there anything that you could suggest to people out there?
Okay. So first about choosing the journal. Well, for that, what I normally do is look at the papers I am including in my paper, where they've been published, and then I try to submit a journal to one of those journals because, sorry, submit my paper to one of those journals because journals love it when you put a citation from their own journal. So it kind of a bit increases your chances, and it also helps you realize which journals are relevant to your field.
Yeah.
With a field like mine right now, which is virtual reality, it can be quite interdisciplinary. So for my PhD, I've published in engineering-based journals, whereas now for my research stay, I'm looking at more psychology-based journals just because our target audience is psychologists and psychiatrists.
Yeah.
And virtual reality can be really used, is being used in any field now. So, you know, where to publish really depends what your target audience, who do you want to read it. Then once you are at this stage, you've submitted it and you get reviewers' feedback. It can be harsh. It can be harsh and it can put you down a bit. But I think what you need to keep in mind is you're just a student. Like, you don't know how to write a perfect paper. And even people who have been in academia and have hundreds of publications, they still get rejections and harsh comments. And I think that's really a great thing because research cannot be reliable if we wouldn't have these comments from all these other people. And yes, when you see a comment that says, oh, maybe the way you've done this experiment isn't the best way, and you've put so many hours on it, it can be really, really frustrating, but it's feedback. At the end of the day, the research community wants to expand the knowledge in a way that's not biased, at least like as much as possible. There will always be some biases and reliable. And that's all reviewers are trying to do, give you feedback. So don't take it personally. They don't know who you are. They are not mad at you, and I don't care, you know. They're just trying to give you feedback so that you can even improve your own work. It's also good for you because if you're pursuing a PhD after 3, 4 years, 5 years, depending on how long your PhD takes, you will be submitting a thesis and you'll be in a viva. And there will be different examiners that will be questioning everything about your work, and that you might even sit there questioning your work yourself, thinking, oh, like, what did I do wrong? Why do they think this was not great? So I think while you're doing your publication throughout your PhD, it's a good practice for you to reflect on your work when you read these reviewers' comments and think about how you can justify how you did what you did. And you know, even if you did, and if you do disagree with a reviewer's comment, you can say it. You can thank them for their comment, thank them for their time. However, you chose this methodology, you chose to include this citation, whatever it may be, because of the following reasons. And if you have good reasons, then that's all that you really, really need. So don't take reviewers' comments personally. Just see it as feedback, constructive feedback, and think of how you can address them professionally and make the changes I suggest, or stick with your own way if you believe that's better. And that's just going to help you in your viva and as a researcher in the long term to be more confident about your own work and see your own work more critically as well.
Yeah, I think as you say, taking these comments in a good stride is so important.
Yeah.
You can have reviewers who also have conflicts of interest, so you have to be very careful. But in the long run, these comments are very, very helpful. If you're working on a literature review and you have reviewers who are obviously looking at a piece of work that is more, more qualitative. Then I'm guessing, in a way, they're only looking at the text, at the academic literature. But if you've got submitted an article that is more experimental with a lot of data, this is where Taking reviews comments is really, really important because once you've performed all these experiments and you're coming to your Viva, as you say, these questions could come again. You know, any questions that are coming from these reviewers could come again from an external examiner or from the internal examiner as well. So, you know, it's all in all for academia and for the people of academia. So they want you to do well at the end of the day, and you never know, like you might be working with these people at some point. So I think it's coming to our next question. I think networking is very, very important in academia, and just kind of developing a community of people who are working with similar interests as you, similar passions as you, probably from different countries, maybe from different universities. But was there anything that you did at uni that, you know, made you kind of network with different people in your field? Or were you kind of just, you know, talking to different people from different fields and getting advice from them as well? But it was it more you know, people based in VR and AR and that kind of environment, or you know, were you open to different people and were you talking to different PhD students from other areas as well?
Well, when it comes to networking in the more like business term, like going to conferences and stuff like that, which are great opportunities, unfortunately, my first couple of years of my PhD, I wasn't able to do so due to COVID, truly be out there and meet researchers face to face. However, once this COVID ban stopped and I was able to go to conferences or just networking events, I was open to speaking to everyone, to people of different fields, because, you know, I may have done a PhD in biomedical engineering, but I find other fields incredibly interesting as well.
Absolutely.
When you work in a team of people of different fields, you can come up with a really, really great project. Like, for example, my current project now, which is mainly based on research in psychology. It hasn't much does not have much to do with engineering besides the VR part, but I find it still very interesting. And on my team, it's people with different backgrounds, in different psychology backgrounds, psychiatry, and then there's me with an engineering background, and I think we are doing something really great that could help people in the long run. So don't be closed off by other people's disciplines or their fields, because together I think you can really come up with something great, because not everyone knows everything. And when you do a PhD or when you're in academia and you research a specific field, you know your field so well, but you need to remember you need help from people in other fields that are doing other research to really come up with a great project and expand your own knowledge as well. So don't be shut off by people who are doing other research. Be interested in other people's stuff, speak and learn about other people's work. It's gonna help you grow as a researcher and even as a person. You will have so much more knowledge. And at the end of the day, when you come home from a networking event or after you have just met someone, you feel great. I don't know, at least me, I feel great. I'm like, wow, I learned so much today. Like, it's so cool what these people told me. I feel inspired to continue my work as well. Seeing other people doing great work motivates me in my work, because you can see, okay, people's work actually has an impact on the world, on people, on whatever your research may be. It's great. Don't be shut off by other people's fields. Really speak to everyone. That's even a life advice, I think. Just speak to everyone and find out what other people are up to. It's great. I think that's
Yeah,
great.
I think also when, as you say, when you're working as a team with different disciplines as well, people can kind of chip in and like they help you out with their own, you know, with their own expertise. Which I'm guessing is a similar for your case as well. But when I was working with surgeons, it's so interesting to see the way they think. Obviously, a surgeon was this thinking differently to an engineer, but
Sure.
you just learn so much, even in terms of discipline. Like a surgeon is coming in at 7 a.m., 6 a.m., just to set up an operation theatre, And you can see the way that they're working long hours, sometimes, 8 till 8 p.m., 9 p.m. But you just see the dedication and you see the passion of these people. And you can see that whatever you're working for, working towards, if that can help that person, even by 5% or by 10%, just to make their life a little bit easier, you
For
just
sure.
feel, as you say, so rewarded. You just feel so nice about yourself and about the research that you're doing, I think.
Exactly. You see how your research firsthand impacts someone. That's so rewarding. Because when you're sitting at your desk doing your research by yourself, sometimes you are thinking, why am I doing this? What is this going to help? But when you can see someone who needs this help, really rewarding. Like, nothing beats that.
I know. So, in terms of virtual reality, are there any examples that you could give to our audience who are probably thinking, "Oh, what is virtual reality?" Because it sounds so interesting. What is virtual reality currently being used in? What type of industry? And also, what is the potential impact of projects like virtual reality in healthcare at the moment, which you're working in? What is the impact that you've seen? And are these projects currently being deployed in hospitals and clinics in the clinical setting, or is it more prototype and proof of concept at the moment?
Okay, so virtual reality, we all know it from gaming. You put on your headsets and you're immersed in this world and you interact with it. But its applications go so beyond gaming. It's seen in education, in industry to train people. It's seen in hospitals for pain management, PTSD. All kinds of different settings. And I think it's really important to be aware of this because a lot of people don't know it until they see a project with it and they're like, oh, I didn't know it could be used for that. And that's really cool. And sometimes we also do still need this gaming aspect though, like when you're trying to distract people from surgery or pain, especially if it's kids, having this little gaming aspect really immerses them in this world where they're not thinking about their pain, where they're not thinking what is actually happening to them. Now, I was really lucky to have seen some really cool project at conferences that work on it. For example, most recently this week I was at a conference and this doctor was talking about his work with veterans. So they have quite a lot of trauma with explosions. And it was this doctor from America. So Americans do have a lot of veterans, especially. And they did this VR simulation with also haptic and sound feedback. So it was a full, not just 3D immersion, like 4D immersion.
So you could feel it.
Exactly, which is really cool. And they mimic this scene, even though it wasn't like too realistic, the graphics, it was more like a game of them driving in like a military truck and seeing an explosion in front of them, which really triggered a lot of patients initially. And they saw after repeated exposure, because they were doing some other treatments as well. So they were, I believe it was TMS doing some other therapy to help them reduce this trauma and this PTSD. But what this VR could do is it could really replicate these emotions that they would feel in these situations. That then, once they would treat the patients with these other methods, with repeated VR exposure, they were able to see whether or not their methods of treatments were effective because they PTSD levels, they reported anxiety and all of that, whether or not it decreased. And it did decrease, but this was due to their other treatment options. But virtual reality was really able to mimic how they felt in that moment, which I thought was really cool. I've also seen it in, it was at another conference at the hospital I'm working, where they were using it with kids. When I believe it was they were changing their crutches, which can be painful, and they would have these kids immersed and play this little like game, and that really helped them with their pain and their distraction. So there are projects out there that have gone beyond the clinical trial phase already, that already employed as treatment options, which is really cool. But considering the technology continues to expand exponentially, like every technology, every year there's a new update, there's new software or something that makes it even better. There is still a lot of research that is being done to virtuality and how it can be used in different settings. Because also some settings you need to be a bit more careful than in other settings per se, based on the application you show. You need to be a bit more careful and do a bit more testing before it can really be given to patients. But so much work has been done, and that is already in the controlled trial phase, and that is beyond that. Now, I do see it keeps increasing a lot as well. I've done a scoping review recently about it in the perinatal mental health field. There were so many publications in 2023 and so many trial registration 2023. So that means in the next few years we will see a lot of publications about this, because it's really growing a lot, and there's more and more research done. So there weren't that many publications for it in 2020, 2019, but 2022, 2023, lots of trial registrations started to happen. So that just means the next few years we'll get some publications about its effect. Well, in this case, it was in perinatal mental health, but I believe it's the same with a lot of other fields. It keeps growing.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. But in terms of perinatal mental health, are there certain, as you say, are there certain restrictions when it comes to performing these trials? I'm presuming you must have done that at university as well. But working with participants, especially human participants, is there anything that you have to be aware of as a researcher when you're performing these types of trials? How easy is it, or how difficult, I might say, are these trials to do?
Well, when you're working with human participants, there's so many things you need to consider. First of all, you have to go through so many months of getting back and forth with an ethics committee. It's because we don't want to expose our patients to something that can potentially harm them. We want to do them good, no harm. Of course, in the ethics and when to the patients, you need to disclose any possible harms, because anything can have a possible harm. But before you can really do a proper clinical trial, there are so many other steps. Once you have ethics approved, you first need to do a feasibility study with perhaps a bit less participants. Then it goes into the pilot phase, a pilot study. The amount of participants on the pilot study, there are methods to calculate how many participants you need. And then once you have a successful pilot study, you can then go to the clinical trial phase, which has the most participants, where you are exposing lots of people to this technology. And only after that, it could potentially go in the market or be used as a treatment method. So there's lots of steps, and it takes a lot of time. It's not a work you can easily do in a few months. It normally takes years, because we really want to do a thorough job and make sure we do more good than harm, especially right now. With perinatal mental health, it's a very sensitive time period when someone is pregnant or when someone is expecting a baby. There's so many changes, especially for the person that is carrying the baby. The changes are physical, psychological, social, so many. But even to the other parent, it's a big stressor, and it can be a very beautiful thing if we approach it right. And some people, unfortunately, are in some circumstances where they do not have as much support, as much help to approach this time of their lives, right? So when we want to find a treatment option for them to support them, we want to be very careful not to trigger any emotions that they might have or any bad experiences that they might have. So
Absolutely.
there's lots of things you need to consider when you're working with participants and human patients.
That's really interesting, actually. But I think also the good thing is several universities at the moment, especially in the UK, but I'm presuming in Canada and obviously America as well. With our own university, I know that Dr. Jim Ang was working with a couple of participants with dementia at the time. And, that kind of immersive environment, be it for people with dementia who are looking to, maybe re-experience what they had, what they felt as, as a younger person, I guess. Just putting them in that kind of environment. And the same as you say for people who are currently, expecting a baby. These are more the virtual reality side is just really immersive and it helps them. I'm guessing also with their emotions, because there are a lot of things that, real life and real world can trigger. And especially during COVID, I think a lot of these things might have helped people, I'm guessing, because obviously everyone was locked out, as you say. So, a lot of people, I've heard a couple of other students working with, immersive restaurants or immersive food tasting. These kind of things are, I can see the potential, and I can see that why people are so interested in working with virtual reality and currently augmented reality as well. In my case, with surgeons, they're looking to make surgery as easy as possible and deployable. So with, cases where you're using a robot, you don't want to be spending 3 hours, 4 hours doing a surgery. So all of this, where you can, superpose any kind of augmented object with
Yeah.
during the surgery, it's so interesting. And I think this is the future, and I think this is going to be something that people are going to be looking into. And it's got a lot of potential.
No, I definitely agree with you, especially if you want to expose people to some, I don't know, trauma that they've had, or to certain situation, or a rehabilitation setting. Anything that might be a bit more sensitive, it's a very controlled and safe way to expose them to these dangerous or unhappy situations.
Or
Without
happy
actually,
situations as well, I guess.
yeah, or happy.
Just immersing yourself, feeling like you're at the beach or having a nice walk in
Yeah,
the
it's a safe and controlled way to expose someone to anything that they need exposure to or they want to, without actually being there.
absolutely. And I think also being a woman in this kind of research field. I think we both relate to this. And there's a lot of it's a hot topic out there. Oh, woman in engineering, what does that mean? How does it feel to be a woman in engineering? I think you might agree as well. Working at the university has been one of the nicest experiences, I think, in terms of being respected as a woman and being given your due. I think you might know as well. We were quite limited in number back in the day. I think we were just maybe you could count on your hands the number of girls that were walking around in lecture theatres or
Yeah, I can still count them.
but I think in terms of actually being given your due, do you think that women in engineering are doing well? And can you see, like, obviously in terms of, you can even look at publications, look at people who are the editor at the moment in these types of journals. Look at, people in engineering who've set up their own startup companies or who are currently working in the Big Four, all that kind of environment. Do you feel that, as a woman in engineering, do you feel safe? And is this a safe environment to work in? Do you feel comfortable? And if there is anything, or if there are any challenges that you faced, what did you do, or what was the kind of support that you got to kind of face those challenges?
Right, so I felt that I was very lucky for with my experience. I had as supportive supervisors. I had multiple supervisors, and they were all very supportive. Two of the supervisors were women, two of them were men. They were all very supportive and were really pushing me to do my best. So I myself did not face as many challenges due to my gender as perhaps some other people have in other institutions or in other countries that are not as advanced as England is. So I do feel safe. I do feel happy being a woman in engineering. I think, sometimes when I tell people, oh, I'm a woman pursuing a PhD in engineering, people that are on the field, they're a bit shocked. They don't see it as something as common as it actually could be. Because I do think in our university, we were lucky we had quite a few female colleagues that were also pursuing a PhD and that did very, very well in their academic journey. I think perhaps the problem might arise for us later on in our lives if we choose to have a family and to have children. That's when some issues might arise, as it might set our career back a bit. That is in every field. That's not necessarily just engineering. In every field, when a woman decides to take time off to look after her child and then wants to go back to work, there's a setback. But so far, I can't say I've had a bad experience. I was very supportive. I thought our university had a lot of support programs for women to really help them pursue a career in engineering. I do have to say in undergrad, where perhaps we were just a few girls and many guys, it didn't feel as much of a women empowerment community. But all the guys were very lovely, were supportive. I have to also say that there will always be someone that has something to say about you being a woman in engineering. Now, I've had unpleasant encounters with some of my male undergrad peers. That I feel like you have that in every field. I was speaking to a friend that is a lawyer, and she's had that encounter because her field of law is more economics and financial, and that's a very male-dominant field as well. And she had great support, but also unpleasant encounters. I think as women, we just have to remember, that we're just as capable of doing these things as anyone else. And I personally, when someone makes a comment, do not let it really get to me. It's like, okay, you don't think I should be here because of my gender. Great for you. Like, good for you. Have that opinion. It's not gonna affect my life. Just be confident in yourself and you can achieve it. And if you seek for the right support and for the right help, you'll find it. I think it's all about who you surround yourself with. You see, these people are a bit negative about your career choices as a woman. Okay, don't associate yourself with them. Go find people that support you and want the best for you.
But there are going to be loads of people out there. Obviously, you might start off with that kind of mentality, or people might start off with that kind of mentality that, oh, if she's a woman in engineering, that means that, they have the right to, have derogatory comments, or just feel that, oh, because you're a woman here, like you don't belong in this kind of space. But as and when, I've looked at several from women in engineering and their kind of journey, you see that these setbacks make you stronger and they kind of build your personality in the end. Because this is obviously the start of our research career. But along that journey, you're going to face many more little setbacks, not necessarily just like with that kind of environment, but it could be other things. And I think it's so important to build that kind of personality, to build like a tough skin when you're working in this type of community.
It definitely is. It's very important to be tough, to perhaps also have a great role model or a mentor that you can go to
100%.
and speak with, feel like and feel supportive. Like, you definitely need a point of contact that's gonna help you. But you do need to be tough and remember what that why you're doing what you're doing. and that's gonna help you get through it. And also, I, you know, when you look at people that often make these comments, they are might not be as happy with their lives as you might be with your. I remember, like in undergrad, it was very funny. There was this person that asked me, "Why am I doing an engineering degree when I'm a woman?" Right. He was another student. That year, he dropped out. And fast forward for a few years, he was still working in a career that's, let's say, not very legal, not something, you know, someone's parents would be proud of their child doing.
I didn't send them to uni for that.
Yeah, exactly. So you like consider the bigger aspect. Don't be hurt by a comment. Just try to take it light and say, and remember why you're doing it, and think about, okay, this person might also not might have other things going on in their lives that makes them think this way, and it's not about me. Like, I know what I'm doing great. And we also live in a free world. Everyone is entitled to their opinions, right? Just don't let them get to you.
Absolutely. And I think also for me, social media really helps. I don't know about like obviously LinkedIn as a platform, but also Instagram. And I think finding, as we spoke about earlier, that network, that community of girls, it could be in person. Like for us, I think obviously we were lucky to find each other because we had, that kind of support. And also with our, obviously our main academic advisor who we've been with for years now, I think he was also a point of, he was always just always supportive, like to all of us, all of us girls. And I think that's very important. And that also counts as obviously the work environment. Like if you have people like that who are surrounding you, who are always positive and always cheering you on, I think that's what's going to motivate you to do better.
Definitely find a great mentor. We were lucky with our
Very lucky.
supervisor. He was very, very motivational, especially for women to not feel set back by their gender. And he was very good with that. So, you know, have a good support network that you can rely on. And for some women, it might be easier to find on social media because they're not as lucky as us being in an institution that they're that's as supportive. But you know, you can find support anywhere.
Yeah, there are always different, different points of call, different people or different, community, as you say, conferences, you might find people there. So always have an open mind. Always be happy to do things. If you're called on to do a talk or you're called on to go to a conference or attend a workshop, always be open because you never know who you might find and you never know who you might meet. But I think also in terms of staying on that topic, I think obviously with recruiting and with onboarding, I think recruitment of women in engineering, there's always that mentality of, if this woman were to, to for to, to have a baby or to start a family, or there are other things, other factors that women are obviously considered the weaker gender as compared to males. So do you think that mentality is still there when, you're going to an interview and say you're competing against, I don't know, a male who's probably got the same PhD level, same number of degrees? Obviously you could be equal in that kind of way, but do you still feel that that mentality is still there where, oh, if this woman were to start a family and she were to go on leave for a while, this work is going to be affected? Do you think that mentality is still there?
Well, you know, I think it's there with the older generation because I think when you look at the even academia, people that have been tenured and have you know, high administration roles from the older generation, it's mainly men. I've even seen in psychology, which is predominantly a woman-dominated field, the top positions, men have them. That's
That's
with the
true.
younger generation. I do think it's slowly starting to change because mentalities are starting to change. Lots of women don't want to take maternity leave, but their partners want to. Like it's all about mentality, And I think with our younger generation, our mentality is really shifting, and hopefully it's changing for the better. I think, it might still be there, but I think for this, it's because it's always going to be a problem if a woman had not a problem if a woman has a baby, but it's going to always going to be a problem in the work setting. Like, will she be set back? And will she be able to come back and start where she left off? And I think a lot of organizations nowadays are trying to be to create programs so that women are not set back. We're seeing childcare more and more often in the company to make sure the women are up to date with the work so that they know when they get back, they can get the same position where they left off. So that's really important, and that's more obviously from the administration side and for the organization from the organization side point of view. I think they are doing much, much more nowadays to include the women who want to have a child. I think it's slowly changing, but it has a long way to go. And we also have to consider we are speaking from Western countries that have already these policies in place to support women that perhaps other countries don't really have. So to get that everywhere, it will be hard. And in other places, women are still discriminated on based on their gender at work. I think for us, we are slowly going to generation where we'll be less and less discriminated. And our ability to bear children will be seen less and less as a threat to a company.
I know, and that it's actually really it's a really sad thing because, I actually have a friend who's currently a surgeon, and she's just had a baby, but she's still multitasking. She's working. She was working in a migration clinic. She was a GP. She was managing a hotel that they own, which is a family business, and so. She's just delivered her baby and she's still working, still managing the hotel, obviously out of, from home. And she's doing a lot of things that I'm presuming a male wouldn't probably have been able to done to be doing, like, it's really fascinating to see the way a woman works. As they say, if you educate a woman, you educate a nation. So if you're able to, respect a woman in the field that she's working in and to break that glass ceiling effect to, as you say, a lot of times when you're looking at the CEO position, it's always a male. But at the moment, currently, the current sometimes you do see, like, the CEO of Chanel, for example, she's a woman. A lot of these people, are currently thinking out of the box. They're looking for people who can, first of all, multitask because women are so used to that. We're used to multitasking. We're used to doing all these things. And obviously, I think it's really important as well to include males, to include men in these type of conversations. Because when we were at uni and our academic advisor was there, obviously, as a man, he understood what our struggle was. So I think that's why we all got along so well. Because we included these men in conversations like, oh, we're struggling, can you help us out? And when you're showing obviously your vulnerability, but you're also in a way saying, look, I can do this, but I just need your support. I think it's more support, less rivalry that we have to look at. Because if these
Great.
men support you in, in a more holistic way, it will be so much better and everyone will get along so much well. Less rivalry, I think, because sometimes when men think of gender equality, they're like, oh, she's trying to be, she's trying to do everything herself. She's independent, so let her do it. It's more of like a rivalry, but it should be more supportive, I think. Especially in engineering, I would say, having that support is I think imperative to a good research career.
Definitely, it should be more of a collaboration rather than a rivalry. And everyone has weaknesses, and we should just own up to them and say, look, I am having a problem with this. If it's about pregnancy, oh, I'm pregnant, I'm struggling to do this task because of, I don't know, my morning sickness or something. Can you help me out? It's really about the support and collaboration. Luckily, lots of administrations and organizations are trying to implement policies that can support us. But yes, definitely, I agree. We need to think of it as a collaboration rather than a rivalry.
Yeah, I think also developing that type of framework as well for women who are obviously throughout the next couple of decades, I'm seeing a lot of potential in, women both in engineering but also in STEM as well. So, implementing policies and having that type of framework available in institutions is really important because then you're looking at a future where women are feeling safe, but they're also supported by several different laws and regulations. They're supported not just by, just the moral support, but you also have, this framework that's available. But
Yeah.
yeah, I think we're looking at a future that has a lot more women, hopefully, fingers crossed, in engineering. And I think I feel hopeful. Because the people that I've worked with who are women, with you and with our other colleagues as well, I've seen, a lot of good work, a lot of research that can be built upon that could potentially be obviously still currently in prototype stage, but can really, really have an impact on future generations.
Yeah, I do feel very hopeful as well. I do think in the future we'll see many more women in STEMs because a job doesn't have a gender. Like, if a woman wants to do it, she can do it. The same way if a man wants to go in a mostly female predominant field, like, if he wants to do it, he can do it. And that's the beauty of it. We
I
shouldn't
know.
stop someone just because of who they are.
No, it doesn't define them. It just is. It's what they do, and it was the output that matters. At the end of the day, it's the type of research that's being promoted, that's being published out there. And I think it's just really important to be there for each other. I think no matter what, just to be there for each other, just to be a bit more positive, and be more open, even in terms of having the LGBTQ plus community as well, just being inclusive. And I think that's really important as well when you're applying to jobs. I know a lot of jobs now at the moment have that type of policy that they have to employ. I've seen that in a lot of job applications as well. In the job description, it does say that since women are so underrepresented in this field, they're looking for more females. So having that in the job description is so important as well because that just promotes, a sense of, oh, okay, so that means that I can apply for this too because they're looking for more women. And I think that was there for our stage as well. But I think when I applied, I did see that, oh, they're looking for more women because it's so underrepresented. Currently, I think in our institution, I think there's might be, I could count on my fingers the number of female lecturers there are. But it's so important to be able to feel safe, to have a safe haven for people to say, to have a conversation like we're having at the moment, breaking all those stereotypes. But this conversation is not had. It's that people are not wanting to have conversations like this because they feel that it's going against all rules and it's going against what's currently out there, I think.
No, we should have these conversations and include everyone in them. Every person from every community, whether that's gender or race, religion, should include everyone and in these conversations and make sure people are hired based on their skills, not
Yes,
what they look like. That's
absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chantal. I really, really enjoyed speaking to you today. And I hope our audience also enjoyed and learned something from us, not just rambling, but also just giving a lot of, tips and tricks for younger women out there. This is our second episode, and we're looking to invite several other guests. Not just obviously research and career related, but looking at other lifestyle and wellness tips. So thank you so much for tuning in with us today, and see you next time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.